Nymons have you seen today? Three. How many Nymons?
He says he was the only one.
How many Nymons?
He says he was the only one.
How many Nymons have you seen today?
Don't dare blaspheme the Nymon.
How many Nymons have you seen today?
Don't dare blaspheme the Nymon. You meddlesome hussy.
Happy day, meddlesome hussies, and welcome to episode 134 of the Friends of the Nymon podcast, the fourth best Nymon-based podcast out there. I'm Mark.
I'm Hayden, and I appear to be in the wrong podcasting room. I'd better go to Diddly Dum next door. See ya.
Hey, see what's happening? What's happening?
Oh, bugger.
Go to the toilet. Mark, give me that conch.
My dreams of conquest.
Give me that conch.
How many podcasts have you listened to today?
Three.
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 134 of the Diddly Dumb podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Despicable Doc.
I'm the Honourable Hayden.
I'm Mephistophelian Mark.
And if you haven't already guessed what we're going to be doing today, there's no hope for you. I think we'll start off by saying I hope you'll make allowances for us this time, faithless listeners. We'll do our best with the edit to clean it up. But if the noise quality isn't of the finest, you'll have to bear in mind that it's a sweltering hot day here in the UK. And there's only so much we can do with closing windows and turning off fans before we'll disappear in a flurry of talcum powder. It's been a strange lockdown, hasn't it? We've all been growing our hair because we can't go to barbers. Mark's beard's been growing even longer. Hayden started growing a beard and then shaved it off until he'd only got... let's see a photo of that moustache that you left yourself again, Hayden.
All right, calm down, I'll get it out now.
Oh, my oath! You wouldn't ouch that served with onions, would you? Oh, I've never seen anything like that in all my puff. Oh, make it all sick, that would.
They do that, though, don't they, though?
And talking of dreadful impersonation, friend of the show, Miles Northcott, with his Doctor Who's Line Is It Anywhere podcast, is almost imminently recording a special episode of his podcast, which is going to be going out in several weeks, which is going to be a charity special to raise funds for the NHS. Otherwise, there's no way we'd have plugged it. We'll plug it nearer to the time, of course, but they're expecting to be joined by several celebrities, with Sophie Aldred, possibly Katie Manning, if she can get her technicalities right, lots of people. Also, since we're plugging things... Oh, dear, this is... This is quite dejecting, and we thought we were muscling our way through to towards the top of the tree of Doctor Who podcasts. The 42 to Doomsday podcast is resurrecting itself. And so I suppose we'll just have to know our place, won't we? Get back in our proper position.
Yeah, but who wants to be at the top of the summit anyway? There's higher to fall.
That's true.
So who wants it? Us. We want it. We want all the glory.
What have we been up to since last we joined you? Mark, you've been listening to comedy, haven't you?
Well, I haven't been listening to it. I watched it. A comedian called Daniel Kitson, who he doesn't do any telly nowadays. I think he was the electrician in Phoenix Nights back in the day. And a friend bought me a ticket for a gig that he streamed. It was actually a gig that he'd recorded in 2011, but with the lockdown on, he'd finally had enough time to edit it. And so he put that out live, sold tickets for it. He only sold as many tickets as there were at the venue. I think he did recordings back in 2011 in New York, the UK and Australia. And he streamed this gig at different times for different audiences around the world. So he streamed the American gig for the evening in whatever the American time zone was. And same with the Australian one. So that was nice. And you got a live introduction from him and stuff. And all the money from it went to charity. And he only sold tickets in the same quantity that he'd previously sold tickets for the gigs.
Yeah, I think it's quite honest, only selling as many tickets as would normally fit in the venue he was going to be playing at. So what was the sound quality like in the Panopticon, Mark?
Well, it was great. No, it was the whole thing. It was streamed live, so you had video as well as audio.
And I can see from the bandages tightly bound around Mark's ribs that he must have been having a good old laugh.
Yes, I did, actually. Yeah, I think my next-door neighbour must have wondered what I was up to.
Yeah, I could hear his ribs popping whilst I was listening to Metallica's The Black Album last night. So,
Hayden, have you been up to anything since last we spoke? Anything fascinating?
No, nothing fascinating, but I have been watching an awful lot of Tom Baker Doctor Who, if that would be of any interest to anyone.
Are you still working backwards through his series?
Yes, I am still working back through his series, and I'm now up to, or should I say, back to season 13, which is my favourite season of Tom's reign, and probably all of Doctor Who as well. Obviously, that's Terror of the Zygons through to the Seeds of Doom. And I finished watching The Android Invasion today, which was my first Tom Baker story as well, ironically enough. And I fell asleep during part three. Woke up again, and there was Stigrun and Guy Crayford in the rocket, re-entering Earth with Benton and Harry and some bloke in a Nicholas Courtney moustache in a control centre talking about him.
Oh, Mother from the Avengers.
Oh, of course he was, wasn't he? Yes.
Yeah, so it's a good story, but pales in comparison to all those around it, I think.
So if you've reached season 13, you must have had the opportunity then to work back through Leela's episodes and remember how marvellously you thought she performed.
Oh, I thought Leela was a great companion. I'm just a little upset at how abrasive the dynamic is on occasion, which is a shame. And I do believe that, I think I might have said to you chaps in recent times off this podcast, so I'll repeat it again to your boredom, but for the delight of the listeners listening, that I think when people say how much they hated Peter Capaldi telling people to shut up, they should go back and watch season 15 and see how many times Tom Baker and Leela tell each other to shut up. No difference whatsoever.
Other than the tell the K9 to tell you to shut up, Mark, I don't remember it, but I bet now. Thing is, you know what you've done, Hayden, don't you? You know you've ruined the Leela era for all of us, because we won't be able to watch it now. Anyone who's heard that without noticing every time they tell each other to shut up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would apologise, but I'm sorry, but that's just not the kind of person I am.
You don't think I've done absolutely nothing. You don't think anything, Mark? Other than serving the nation, by the way, working away.
No, I haven't done it a lot, to be honest. My friend Nick, by the way, who left his headphones out when he was listening to the podcast on the train, so all the train carriers got to hear Diddly Dumb.
Has that got to hear a Terence Dix impersonation as his headphones jack popped out?
Sorry, who was impersonating Terence Dix?
I just realised, yes. I can't imagine.
Anyway, it was him who brought me the ticket for the Daniel Kitson gig. And also, he tried out some classic Who on his 12-year-old son, Leo. I think I've got the age right. I'm sure he'll tell me if I haven't. And I think a couple of years ago, he showed him Robot, and he quite enjoyed it. But obviously, he's forgotten about all that now. But he showed him Genesis of the Daleks, or at least they're working their way through Genesis of the Daleks. And Leo loves it, which I was pleased to hear. And he's now been going around telling his friends that the best Doctor is Tom Baker.
Quite right.
Marvellous.
And they've been going, Tom Baker, but that's an old one. Yeah, he's much better than the new ones. And he's been telling them that the theme tune and the titles are much better on the old Doctor Who as well than they are now.
Well, he's got a point, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, he has got it.
So are we, in future podcasts, be going to get feedback from Leo, from Elliot, and from the Kelly Girls?
It's entirely possible. Yeah, so it's nice, though. It's lovely that there's a new generation who are going to be... Well, I mean, the Kelly Girls haven't seen any old Doctor Who yet. I mean, I said I haven't seen any old Doctor Who. They've seen stuff that was 15 years ago, which going to be very old to them.
But that doesn't count as old in Doctor Who, does it? Oh, can I just ask, does that mean that we're going to be booted off when we go on our summer expeditions, that we're going to have diddly-dum the next generation taking over our slot?
Only if they've become very popular internet content providers by that time, and then I'll assemble a crack team of internet content providers to take over and moan about the old episodes and watch them.
I was just going to ask them. Yeah, do they watch it sped up on their laptops so that they can get through it quicker?
It's interesting. That's what we call old Doctor Who, because I was rewatching the famous Lively Arts documentary Who's Doctor Who the other day in preparation for this podcast on the season 14 DVD box set we've recently got, which we're going to keep quiet about, aren't we, Hayden? Because Mark didn't manage to get one.
Oh, are we? Oh, I better chuck all these notes away then.
And that was recorded roughly around about the time of, well, roughly around about 1977, and they mentioned Doctor Who has now been going for 13 years. I thought, God, that's 2 years less than the new Who has been going, isn't it? Seems extraordinary how things are like that.
Yeah, I have seen that documentary. It's very good. It's on, because although I don't have the Blu-ray box set, I did break out my Revisitations 1 DVD box set, which has the Times of Wen Chiang is a special edition in that, and it has the Who's Doctor Who documentary on there. It's lovely. But I haven't got the follow-up, obviously.
We'll have to lend it to you sometime, Mark.
Well, you only need to knock on our dormitory doors, Mark, and just ask if we can borrow it, you know. It's in the Hooseum Library, for crying out loud.
Yeah, but I still haven't returned all those Kung Fu books, so I'm not allowed to take any more out.
Oh yeah, if anyone is looking down the target range in the Hooseum Library and see that the Web of Fear's not there, that's not me. I've already got a copy. I'm not entirely certain where that one's gone to, but there you go.
Right. This week, for reasons which I can't quite remember, we're going to be looking at The Talons of Wen Chiang.
I think the reasons for it are that in the last couple of podcasts, I've done a story that I love, Hayden's done a story that he loves, and we wanted to do a story that you love. And also, seeing as the season 14 Blu-ray box set had come out, we thought it'd be a good time to do Talons.
Yeah, well, we did Naimons as one that Mark loved, but Hayden and I thought was a bit meh. We did Webb as one that Hayden loved, but Mark and I thought was, it's okay, but it's not brilliant. We couldn't think of one that I think is amazing, and the other two think is pretty rubbish, because my Doctor Who tastes are quite conventional, really.
I thought you were going to say they were exquisite. and nobody could possibly argue with them.
Oh, thank you, sweetheart.
I thought you were being a bit kind by saying I thought Naimon was a bit meh.
We've also been rewatching it recently, which may have brought it to mind, on these new Blu-ray sets. Talons of Wen Chiang, the last story of season 14. Philip Hinchcliffe's last story as producer. 1977, directed by David Maloney, who, in fact, I was looking at what he's done.
He's got a great hit rate, hasn't he?
Yeah, with the exception possibly of The Crotons, he's directed Mind Robber, Crotons, The War Games, Planet of the Daleks, Genesis of the Daleks, Planet of Evil, Deadly Assassin, and Talons of Wen Chiang. I mean, that's a pretty belting lineup, that, isn't it?
Oh, crikey, this is his last Doctor Who story as well, then.
Yeah. You always hear something when Tom or Liz Sladen, you see them talking about him. They always seem very, very fond of him for some reason. I mean, if you think about Planet of Evil, that means he must have been responsible for that jungle set. The wrecked one there.
Yes, yeah.
To the BBC Studios. Written by Bob Holmes, of course. One of four historicals of Tom Baker's era. You know, I was doing some notes on this earlier today. And I thought, I wonder how many other historicals did Tom have? And I was thinking, I can't remember any. Gosh, is that really unusual? So I pulled up a list of all the series and I thought, oh yeah, well, of course, there was Pyramids, wasn't there? Well, that was the only three. Oh no, of course, there was Mask of Mandragora. Oh, of course, there was Fangrot, wasn't there? So there's quite a few of them. So it's one of four historicals of Tom Baker's era. Of course, none of them are really historicals in the William Hartnell sense, are they? They're really pseudo-historicals. It's something, some alien invasion happens in Earth's history. But I've always been a bit of a sucker for historicals, right? You too.
So yeah,
as a genre,
for the pseudo-historicals, which is what they became. You know, like you said, it's alien menace in Victorian London, for example. You know, yeah, I really enjoy them. I like Black Orchid, even though that's, you know, a two-parter quaint little two-parter, a breather in that season. Yeah, I really like them. I think the only one I can't get on board with, and it's probably because I've not seen it because it doesn't exist, but I struggle with Marco Polo, which may be a bit controversial.
I was about to say, if they got rid of, say, one of the 327 way stations they stop at on the way to visit Kublai Khan, I think it would have cheered that up if they'd just, you know, stuck in a Santaran spaceship crashing in the middle of Mongolia, don't you?
absolutely. That's a very good point, though. Very good point. To be fair, I would take an Absorbalov invasion at one point.
Anyone want to have a go at making a start on Talons?
Yeah, I watched this. I remember the first time I saw it, there was a deal on at W.H. Smith, but they were getting rid of Doctor Who stories for about £4 or £5 per story. And this was in a glut where I bought
DVDs?
About, yeah, DVDs.
Or VHS. Yeah.
Yeah, of DVDs. I'm not that old, Doc.
8-track, was it?
When you said that, I was thinking, oh yeah, you must be talking about the sale that they had on in Volume 1 with the VHS cassettes.
No, this would have been about 2006, 7, I reckon.
Yeah.
When these were on, and there was a lot of Tom stories in there. And there were a few which I was upgrading from VHS. this wasn't one of them. This was the first time I'd seen this. And it was, again, a highly regarded one that I'd seen in that poll back in 98 in DWM, where I think it came third, I think, if I remember off the top of my head. I might be wrong there, but it was definitely in the top 10. And I thought it was a very lavish production. It's clear that for once they'd left the money till the end of the series, hadn't they?
Mm.
Which is interesting, actually, because it's in a season where actually everything looks quite lavish and quite nice, doesn't it? You start off with the Mask of Mandragora and Hand of Fear. Obviously, going on Deadly Assassin, you've got to have the whole Panopticon and Gallifrey sets made and all the rest of it. But maybe because you've got a mixture of filming and video on location, perhaps that gives it a bit more of a finished look in Talons. But no, thoroughly enjoyed. And actually, I'll go beyond thoroughly enjoyed. I think it's my second favourite Tom Baker story after Pyramids of Mars.
It's very theatrical, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I think actually they didn't just save the money up until the end of the season. I think Philip Hinchcliffe went over that and actually spent some of the following season's money as well, didn't he?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Because this was his last one, I think he just went sod it. And so I think there might have been a bit of an overspend on it.
Is that why the Vardens are just bits of tinfoil on coat hangers or whatever it is? Please don't remind me of the Invasion of Time. I'm watching it again over the weekend. I just still really, really enjoy this one. I think it's a lovely end to a very successful season. It's a fantastic closing of the chapter for Hinchcliffe and, as we just said, obviously David Maloney's last director's credit on Doctor Who. I think Tom's absolutely in his element here. I think his relationship with Louise Jameson, even though it may still have been a little frosty off the screen, I think on screen it's starting to find its place at this point. I think Leela's terrific in this one too. And I really liked the threat from Lee Sin Chang and Mr. Sin, but I never found Mr. Sin that creepy. But again, that might just be because I came to this at a later age.
Really?
Yeah, possibly. Because when I was six, well, as I explained during our horror-themed podcast, this was a real boat filler for me. It's the original boat filler. I'm pretty sure that it was the cliffhanger to part two, where Mr. Sin is advancing on Leela with a knife.
Oh, yes.
And look, I've told this story before, but I was so absolutely terrified when I went to bed that when I needed the toilet in the night, I was too scared to leave my room. And I just grabbed a plastic boat that was next to my bed and weed in that.
We kept meaning to do this, didn't we? To use this boat sizes as as our standard gauge of frightening and of scariness in Doctor Who. We've never got around to it, did we?
No, we forgot. It's probably just as well.
Dirty British coaster with a salt-caked smokestack filling up with Mark's piss in the Mad March days.
Yes, I think rating things number of boats of piss or size of boat of piss isn't necessarily the best idea.
So you would have been... This was right at the beginning of 77, so I would have been 10. What do you mean, Mark?
This was...
Lord, I've revealed something there. I didn't mean to reveal something. I might beep that out.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, I think I would... Well, I would have been 5 when it started and 6 when it ended.
What do you, was that scary? It aged you a year.
I was 5 when it started and looked like an 18-year-old man by the time it finished with all my hair gone.
Oh, he's aged you. Skin like an old Bible.
Skin like dried leaves.
So you say this is 1977, this one?
Yeah, came out, I think, February 77.
Yeah, February 77, ran till April.
So how old would you be when you got that W.H. Smith sale, Hayden?
Oh, I was in my mid to late teens, I'd say, at that point.
Right, but... so you're never really going to be terrified of anything, are you? No. It's more you're going to be thinking, oh, isn't that a very scary thing? You're not going to be thinking, oh my God, that's so scary.
No, as we established in that Halloween special, I was only terrified of ITV commercials back in the day.
Oh, yes, so of course. It. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Good old Yellow Pages.
Oh, you fiend.
I think also the cliffhanger to part 5 was another one.
Well, she rips his mask off.
Yeah, and you see his melty face.
Yeah.
That was another boat filler.
I think that was his best part, really, because unfortunately, I think perhaps the one letdown in this story is Magnus Greel. He's a bit of a disappointment, especially when you consider that he's being voiced by Michael Spice. Is it Spice or Spicer?
Spice. Michael Spice is the comedian who does the Man Next Door videos.
Oh, Michael Spicer is amazing as the voice of Morbius. You will remember Faithless Sisters. He was the one who... loosened my bladder at the Blackpool Doctor Who exhibition. As the voice of Morbius, I suspect that leather mask didn't help. I mean, I don't know whether his lines were dubbed on afterwards. I bet that would have cost more money than if I had to hire him for longer, so I bet they weren't.
He is quite a sort of stock villain. I mean, he suits the piece, to be fair, but he is kind of the stock, slightly pantomimish. I mean, certainly the way that he says... let the talents of Wang Chiang shred your flesh.
Oh, I thought that was his best line.
It's worthy of Graham Crowden, isn't it?
I was about to say, as a fan of Nymon, if you were about to criticise that bit, I was going to whack you round the head with a horn.
Not so. Some people make good money for that.
Can we cut that bit?
Leave it.
But there was no really menacing voice there, and I suspect that was that mask they had him wearing. Made up, wasn't it dark, so that he didn't show anything. But, on the plus side, at least he had enough good taste to take his holidays on the Lancashire coast. You know his nickname? The Butcher of Bispham? Oh, sorry, Brisbane. Sorry, guys. But wasn't he usually going to be the master? And then they decided, we just had him in Deadly Assassin. It'll be a bit... I think Philip Hinchcliffe turned that down.
I don't know about that. I know that originally the stories were supposed to be written by Robert Banks Stewart, wasn't it? And it was called Foe from the Future.
Yeah.
But I don't think that was supposed to be the master.
Pretty sure it was, because Philip Hinchcliffe was denying it on the commentary earlier this week. And I suppose, in a way, when you've got a sort of tour de force performance by John Bennett as Chang, although he's meant to be the next boss up, what do they call it on computer games? A boss level.
Yes.
You've beaten Mr. Sin, you've beaten Chang, so you get to... Who's right at the bottom? Ho, do you think it is? He's always going to pale into maybe nothing's insignificant. But I think it was really theatrical, both in the costumes, the sets, and the performances. I mean, literally theatrical in a way, in that they go to the, is it the Northampton Repertory Theatre?
Yeah.
And actually have it as musical. They threw a whole lot of themes into the mix, didn't they? I think it was very much a farewell swan song for Philip Inchcliffe, Sherlock Holmes, Sax Roma, musical, etc. I mean, that whole time cabinet in a Victorian setting can't fail to work well in Doctor Who, can he? It's almost like in reverse the sarcophagi in Edwardian England for pyramids. I mean, they even go so far, don't they, as to redress the leads, which is very unusual in Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you think, that's something else I was trying to think. How many stories do we know where they actually do change? I mean, beyond, let's say, wearing an anorak if they land in on a cold planet or something. There's not many. Even if you go back to William Hartnell's time, they might have ended up, was it when Ian ends up with the Saracens, he ends up dressing in a sort of a Middle Eastern, doesn't he?
But he does that in the Aztecs as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
They don't use the wardrobe that much, do they?
No, but they do it a lot in this one. Are you saying there's a lot of things as well? I noticed there's an awful lot of Phantom of the Opera in here. I don't think I've probably appreciated it when I watched it before.
Yes, yeah.
But I've in recent years, I started watching all the black and white Universal films with my daughter Polly.
Oh, right.
And Phantom of the Opera was the 1925, I think, with Lon Chaney as the Phantom. We've watched that several times. It's quite a favourite of ours. And there's so much of it. So much of it is in this. And then I was reading up about it today. I had a little look. I noticed that, sure enough, at the time, I think Robert Holmes went on holiday and was called back because he thought he'd got a script sorted, and then the one from Robert Banks Stewart fell through. So he had to come back quickly. And I think apparently pretty much the night after he got back, the Phantom of the Opera from 1925 was shown on television. So I can imagine him sitting there scribbling away, thinking, oh God, what do I do? And then suddenly the Phantom of the Opera comes on, and in classic Hinchcliffe era style, he just goes, oh yeah, I'll just do that.
Yeah.
Because there's so much of the Phantom Opera in there, isn't there? It's I mean, obviously it's based in a theatre. They're in the basement of the theatre. You've got the way that Magnus Grille, in the early episode, even has a fedora on.
Oh yes, he does, doesn't he? Yes.
Very much like the Phantom of the Opera does in various situations. Then you've got the stagehand who thinks there's spooky goings on in the cellar, and then who gets murdered, which is Joseph Bouquet, I think, in the film. And it's Casey in here. There's the chase through the flies. That's the bit at the top of the curtains and stuff with all the ropes around the theatre.
Oh, really?
There's a bit like that in there.
You see, for someone like me, I'm completely ignorant of the Phantom of the Opera. All I know is that Frank Spencer was once in it, and...
yeah, it's not that sort of performance.
I've got it. See the lair of the Phantom. Conducted tours, Bob and Nob. I'm onto a fortune here.
I mean, I suppose if Leela had been walking around Victorian London in her skins, it might have been amusing for about 5 minutes, but we'd soon get distracted by all the locals having to express horror at it, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
So they had to dress her up like that. And interestingly, if you think about it, they did exactly the same thing for her in Fangrock, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Which I think is the only other time she gets out of her skins, excuse the expression. In fact, she gets two period costumes in both, doesn't she? Those sort of Victorian, Edwardian period. She gets a second new dress here halfway through. And to the inordinate and rather disturbing delight of our erstwhile host, the Rev, in Fang Rock, she ends up in a baggy jumper, doesn't she? Which disturbed him.
I don't think disturbed is quite the right phrase, is it?
But they still address her savagery with scenes when, I love this scene actually, when Professor Lightfoot's got the banquet on the table.
Oh, isn't it wonderful, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, oh, do you not want a knife and fork? She said, oh, starts cutting at the meat. Oh, it's a good knife. And he joins in with her and just picks up the joint, doesn't he?
Yeah, Trevor Baxter and Louise Jameson are brilliant together in this.
Yeah, they are.
Like that bit where he buys the dresses as well and stuff. And she goes to start changing. Oh, no, not here and stuff. And he's all bashful about having been out to buy dresses for her. And then she comes down and they're all like... Wow.
Mark,
yeah.
Will you put down that joint, please?
Pass the ashtray, Hayden.
That's almost like My Fair Lady, isn't it? Where
oh,
she...
Oh, that's very... Yeah, Pygmalion.
They go out and they buy... The guys buy her the dress. Although, I did think that she goes upstairs. Mrs. Hudson's waiting upstairs to help you change.
That June Hudson.
The Doctor and Lightfoot have a very brief chat about the cabinet. And within about the space of 4 or 5 lines, she reappears downstairs fully dressed. Now, you have to wonder, did Mrs. Hudson just let her... Did she not sort of change out of that Victorian underwear that's soaked with sewer water, love? Or did she just dump the new dress on top of it?
Well, maybe she's an ancestor of June Hudson, and so she's extremely quick with costume changes.
That explains the leather from Magnus Greel's costume as well.
Yeah, exactly.
How inspiring that became.
From a little shop on the King's Road.
Yeah. Can I just say, you know, one of the big criticisms of this story is the big rat.
Mm. Yes.
The giant rat. I was watching it this time round and I thought, oh, they've done really well with that rat there. And then I realised come the end of the episode I hadn't had it turned on the new CGI.
You had or you hadn't?
I hadn't. It was the original version. It just looked better this time. I don't know why. But
the best thing about the new version is really that you barely see it at all.
Right.
They've not really remade it that much. The most you see is that it's ears, really. But you just barely see it. You just get a vague shape in the background, which I think is the way they should do it in the first place.
I'm not really interested in seeing... I don't mind the flaws. I like to see things as they appeared on television. I don't care if the effects look a bit crappy.
No.
It's fine, as long as they have both on the disc.
Yes.
So yeah. It's not like Star Wars where they jumped the original and you can't ever see it again. Then that's fine. You know, because people do love the new versions, you know, and if that's what they want, let them have it.
Well, remember the snake, I mean, the one time where I think it has worked to great effect is the snake in Kinder, is when they have gone back and done the CGI, and I thought that was brilliant.
That's never bothered me.
No, that's fair enough. No, never really bothered me either, but I forget to put the CGI on for these new things.
Now, chaps, it's... 4 minutes to the 8 o'clock clap. Do you want to go and have a fag, Mark?
Oh, yeah, could do. Would you, want to do that?
Can we leave everything running yet?
Yeah. Should we reassemble at 5 past?
Okay, all right.
Yeah, okay.
Go for it. Okay.
See you in a bit, chaps.
See you in a bit.
Bye.
See you in a bit.
Some nuts, a cool glass of orange, why not try a hot dog? From the sales staff and in the foyer, now.
May we remind you that for the convenience of those patrons who prefer not to smoke, seating areas on the right-hand side of this auditorium have been designated as no smoking areas. Your cooperation is appreciated.
Right, so where were we? We're talking about how Hayden was watching it without the new special effects on, weren't we?
Oh, yeah, that's it, yeah.
I mean, I think the sewers tunnels look amazing, the rat aside. I've reached a bit of an impasse.
I have to say, speaking of the rat in the sewers, when I was watching this today, I was wondering if there's anything remotely... I absolutely love this story. I really do. It looks amazing. I think the performances across the board are fantastic. The whole production's just brilliant. Roger Murray Leach's sets, as the Doctor said, that sewer set, and the lair, Greel's lair, and that... enormous dragon carved out of polystyrene.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It just looks superb. Mr. Sin's costume maker, all the costuming, it's highly extravagant looking. I do think they just spent far too much money on it, especially compared to other episodes. I think that's why it's so highly regarded. And it's probably why I regard it so highly as well. It's fantastic. But I do have to say, regarding even the rat in the sewer, the giant rat, is there anything in this that is remotely original?
Oh, yeah. This is what I'm starting to wonder about the Hinchcliffe era, is the reason why it's bloody brilliant is because it's an absolute magpie, isn't it? It's taken everything that works from different genres and put it into Doctor Who, which just makes it even better.
Yeah, they've gone for a lot of low-hanging fruit, haven't they?
Mm.
You know, they did Frankenstein. They were going to do Dracula. Obviously, The Mummy.
Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
They've gone for a lot of what, Mark?
Low-hanging fruit.
Do you have to bring up those wet Victorian undergarments again? Leave it to you to put the pig in Pygmalion, Mark.
I mean, here, it's sort of like Sherlock Holmes, Fu Manchu, Phantom of the Opera, and even an episode of The New Avengers called Gnaws, G-N-A-W-S, which features an isotope gets dropped down a sink in a laboratory, like they do, and it goes into the sewer. And
isn't that the opening credits to The Simpsons?
yes, that's it. Yeah, Homer Simpson drops the isotope down in the sewer. That's a Strangler song, rest in peace, Dave Greenfield. And it basically creates a giant rat which prowls around the sewers. And they even used, for the giant rat, they had a normal-sized rat in a tiny model of the sewer.
Was that pre this or post this?
Just before it. I think it's the end of 1976. So it is possible that that came out in December 76, and this was February 77.
I was arguing about this with someone on Twitter last week. But if you think about it, yeah, robot, there's King Kong there, isn't there? Ark in space, not really. Sontaran Experiment, no. Genesis, no. Revenge of the Cybermen, no.
But they were all commissioned by Barry Letts and Terrence Dix. It wasn't until you got to Terror of the Zygons.
Oh, I thought it was just Robot that was.
No, because it was Barry Letts and Terrence Dix who commissioned Terry Nation to write Genesis, and Nation delivered the script, and then they said, there's nothing wrong with it at all, Terry. It's just that you've submitted it to us twice before.
Okay. So, Terror of the Zygons, no.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
What, for Android Invasion?
No, for Terror of the Zygons, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's body doubles, isn't it?
I suppose so.
And Loch Ness Monster.
Yeah, Planet of Evil's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
What's that one with Leslie Nielsen?
Forbidden Planet. It's Forbidden Planet,
is what it is.
Yeah.
Police Squad.
Police Squad. Yeah. Who are you and how did you get in here? I'm the locksmith. And I'm the locksmith.
Pyramids is every Hammer story, isn't it? Android Invasion is even more Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Brain of Morbius is Frankenstein.
It's a bit Village of the Damned as well, Android Invasion.
Yeah, true. Seeds of Doom,
the thing from Outer Space, was it? As in the black and white film that was eventually remade in the 80s by John Carpenter as The Thing.
You're right, yes. Yeah, with Kurt Russell. Yeah, it's The Thing. Yeah,
and there's a black and white version of it, wasn't there?
Mandragora, don't say The Prisoner. Hand of Fear.
Well, that's just horror trope, isn't it?
You can't just say, oh, it's horror.
No, but it's a horror trope, isn't it? The five fingers of death, you know, the hand that keeps crawling towards people and stuff.
Doc, you know how you think that, or you know that Doctor Who came up with everything? I'm just thinking of the Hand of Fear. I think it's the monkey paw in The Simpsons, in the Treehouse of Horror.
I've not seen this.
When Homer has three wishes with the monkey paw. It's very Hand of Fear, that.
Deadly Assassin, what they say, don't they?
Manchurian Candidate, that one.
Manchurian Candidate, but I do think that's stretching things a bit far. It's not anything like being a Manchurian Candidate. Except it's a political assassination. Face of Evil. Oh, yes, of course. Bram Stoker's Dracula, where he has the giant face of his carved into the mountainside. Robots of death. Ten little Indians. Yeah, I suppose so. It depends how much you're prepared to scrape off of the barrel to try and find it, aren't you?
But the thing is, I mean, it's absolutely fine to magpie things from culture to make something new, and that they do pull it off.
As long as it's good.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. We wouldn't be sitting here 40-odd years later talking about them still if they hadn't done something wrong.
If we had a social life.
And that. Well, speak for yourself.
In fact, the pedigree of the beasts in the sewers goes back even further than the new Avengers episode, Gnaws, because it goes Gnaws itself is almost a remake of a Thunderbirds episode, Attack of the Alligators.
Oh, which is the one... Yeah, that terrified me as a kid. Didn't talk about that one on the Halloween episode, did I?
No, and they use real alligators, don't they, in a model sewer, I believe.
Yeah.
So, how did we get onto that?
Because you were talking about the rat, and then I started talking about how wonderful it was, but how there's nothing original in this story.
But does that bother you?
No.
There's nothing original.
No, it doesn't.
I think if the quality is there within the writing and the presentation, it's not a problem at all.
No, and you can't deny the quality of the writing in this story.
No.
But it's extraordinary.
It's just absolutely superb.
You could give Bob Holmes an Orphan 55 idea. I was going to say a Chris Shibnall idea. An Orphan 55 idea, and he'd write a brilliant script for it, wouldn't he? Bob Holmes would make What's-Her-Name and Benny a much-loved Holmes in Double Act, wouldn't he?
Yes.
He would, yeah. Yeah, they'd now have 12 seasons on Big Finish already.
Well, they'll probably still come anyway. Give it a couple of years.
Actually, getting onto those two, Jago and Lightfoot, they are wonderful, but I was reminded watching it this time round just how little screen time they have together.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, they don't appear till episode 5 or 6, do they?
No, that's right. An hour and 44 minutes in that they first meet. I mean, when I hadn't watched this for about 15 odd years or so, I first got it on DVD.
8-track.
Eight-track.
What happened when Mark was young is that his local mummers group was having a sale, and so they used to walk around his village and used to do a silent mime about all the Doctor Who stories. Jesters. But I think they are possibly the supreme achievement of the Robert Holmes double act, Jago and Lightfoot. But I think it's so, because everyone focuses on it, it overshadows the fact that there's another double act here, which is Jago and Casey. Who are around for much more of the story than they are. Casey, my factotum. And they have a wonderful relationship. I mean, they're more cronies, aren't they, than master and servant?
Yeah, they are.
Or employer and employee. And you could easily, with Casey, obviously he's an Irishman, and he's terrified of everything, you could easily play him as that awful, sort of, you know, the Irish character in the Fawlty Towers Builders sketch?
Yes.
Well, I mean, they really just pull no punches and say, here's someone who's Irish, so we'll play him as thick. But here, obviously, they play him as constantly terrified of things. But Jago says, you've been drinking.
Yes.
He says, not a drop.
Chains clanking 9 foot tall.
You've been drinking. Not a drop. So it's time you started.
Yes.
I really like the scene with them. Christopher Benjamin and Tom Baker, I think, is it at the end of episode 1 or at the start of episode 2? When he pulls the hanky out and it keeps going and then has the dub.
And Jago just sighs and looks bored.
He's seen it all before.
Yes. He says, oh, I know your game. Well, well done, but you can come back next week.
Auditions commence at 10 o'clock sharp. Supporting acts booked for 1 week only.
Is that all? No, dramatic recitations, singing, tap dancing. I can play the trumpet voluntary and a bowl of live goldfish.
Don't bother coming back on Saturday.
They're like a couple of drinking partners, except they probably don't drink together. When he says he's going out, Jago, he says to Casey, I'm just about to repair for half a foot of port. Which I think is a lovely idea. I'm about to repair for half a foot of dandelion and burdock. What's that other one? Things like...
Hey, go on home with you, Casey. Straight home. You might get mistaken for one of those girls.
And you coming, Mr. Jago?
Not yet.
Some paperwork commands my presence yet a while, but I shall doubtless descry those lugubrious lineaments at the crepuscular hour.
Eh?
See you in the morning.
And I love that sort of thing, how they get on with each other.
Yeah.
They could easily have portrayed Jago as a sort of pompous prick who's bossing around his employees. And then Casey gets the wonderful line, which I think I've missed before, because it quite surprised me when I saw it this time, when Jago's saying all the stress he has, you know, running the theatre, and he says,
I'm an artiste. Every night at this time, I feel like an old war horse scenting the smoke of the battlefield. As the house fills, the blood starts tingling through my veins. My public is out there waiting for me. I can't talk about money at a time like this.
You don't do anything, Mr. Jago.
I announce the acts. I count the tickets. I smile at people. You know, I do the strain it puts on a fellow.
Yeah. Is this the second... only the second example of a Doctor Who character's middle name being Gordon? And is it only the third example of a Doctor Who character having a middle name in the series as well?
Ooh.
Henry Gordon Jago, Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart, and Sarah Jane Smith.
Oh, I see. Oh, yes. It very much takes over once they meet each other, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And all that sort of cowardly stuff about... Lightfoot's being brave, saying, go on, you can do as you wish.
Answer me. Why?
Why were we waiting at the theatre, Lightfoot?
I refuse to answer.
The OIT refuses to answer.
You can do with us as you wish.
I say steady on.
Wasn't it us who discovered that Trevor Baxter was also a plumber?
What's that?
I think it was us, wasn't it? When he passed away recently, we Googled him, and you came across a local plumber doc. Do you remember, called Trevor Baxter?
Oh, that was it, yeah. And you're right about... he's very broadly drawn, Jago, whereas Lightfoot is much different. That's in the, you know, that whole cold collation scene. And you wouldn't dream of embarrassing her by suggesting that she's, you know, she's not got the... Although he does at the very end, after she's just putting his whole bowl of raspberry fool or something to her lips and drinking straight from the bowl, you just have to say, excuse me, napkin, please.
Yeah, Trevor Benjamin's character is, and Christopher Benjamin's, are both so adorable, but I think that's... this is
Trevor Baxter.
We come to one of my problems, is Trevor Baxter's character. I know... because... I know it's in context, in a way, because he was the son of a brigadier...
The brigadier general, yeah.
Yeah, in China. And so he would have been there at a time when... I suppose it'd been the Opium Wars and colonization of bits of China, and so China would have been fairly downtrodden at the time and looked down upon by the British Empire.
Yeah.
And so I suppose from that respect, somebody who'd grown up with that would probably be racist towards Chinese people. But I mean, there's a bit where... does he call them inscrutable chinks?
It's just before Leela says about we're always taught to aim strike under the breastbone for the heart.
Mm.
And he says, most of the corpses around here are jolly dull. Now I've got a couple of inscrutable chinks.
I missed that.
It's just, you know, it may be kind of verite.
It may be how people would have behaved.
Yeah, but
it's yes.
Just I just feel from such a lovely character... to, like, well, and let's make him racist towards the Chinese. I mean, obviously, we're sort of getting towards the elephant in the room, aren't we?
Yeah. But I do think, with the racism element, there is an element whereby there's obviously the stuff none of us would well, hopefully dream of saying today. But if you think about it, you would say exactly that same sort of thing. And if there was no particularly a racial difference between you and the person you were talking about, no one would bat an eyelid. No one would bat an epicanthic eyelid. Because if you'd said, if the guy in Lightfoot's mortuary was in a kilt, he would have said, oh, I've got a couple of jocks in here.
Mm.
Or maybe if there was a couple of taffies.
You're literally just saying words which are in every single Dad's Army episode, and may I point out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making with there is, I mean, possibly if he'd said, I got a couple of frogs, a couple of Frenchmen, we might have sort of, we wouldn't have been appalled by it. But if we're saying, oh, we're happy to say that about fellow Europeans, ethnically, but it's bad if it's really purely because, if we say it about the Chinese purely because of their race, is that itself a racist attitude? That we feel, oh, it must be racist because we're saying it's about another race. Whereas, effectively, you could argue that he would be treating the other race in the same way as he treats another European. Now, having said that, I doubt very much, and this is possibly the point that Mark's making, that someone like Lightfoot would refer to a Scotsman as a jock. Because of that, it's slightly below his class to use stuff like that. So I would agree, it's certainly...
It just jars.
What should we say? It does jar. There's a lot of stuff in here that jars, in a way. There's a point where Leela says, after she's been in Greel's lair, she says...
Oh, the yellow one calls him Lord.
The yellow one calls him Lord. Now, I think that's the worst line in the whole story. And if you think about it, the people who bang on about the racism in Talons...
I'll agree.
You never hear them mention that, do they?
No.
Police sergeant says, when they're in the police station, says, him Giorgio Plenty by and by, eh, Johnny? And he seems to be using pidgin English. That's another appalling thing. People very rarely use that. But very rarely bring that up in stuff that they're criticising.
Could I ask a question of...
No. No, you're not allowed to. How dare you presume to ask, yeah.
The question of this, of the highlighting of the racism and the obviously very politically incorrect moments in this story. Was this ever spoken about in fanzines and
at the time?
Either at the time or before the DWM article a couple of years ago. Was that two or three years ago?
No, but I mean, I can remember people mumbling about it for a long time. I mean, that whole DWM thing was started off by the, shall we say, the sadly missed Time Team, wasn't it? All these millennials expressing outrage at this sort of stuff. But that wasn't new to me. When we heard that, you didn't really think, did we? I'd never thought of Talons in that way before. It's been around for a long time.
It's always been quite obvious. I mean, some of the things that they say is racist there, that I can see the reasons for that. There's, I mean, they talk about the casting, but it seems quite clear to me that this is obviously one of the other huge influences on this story. Obviously, are the Sax Roma stories, Fu Manchu, and especially I think. Probably the that's not a good sentence, especially probably. And also, I think mostly, particularly the Christopher Lee films.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where he's done up for, as a Chinese man. I used to watch those with, you know, without particularly thinking about it, because I did grow up in an era where seeing. Well, Christopher Lee played Fu Manchu, and it wasn't questioned in my circle. Obviously, I've learned these days that it's not the right thing, but the makeup that they give to John Bennett to wear is very much like Fu Manchu. He's definitely being set up as a Fu Manchu-like character. And so that's the reason that they didn't cast a Chinese actor for the role, because they were going for that.
They yes, possibly.
Wanted it to look like a Fu Manchu film.
Although, being a Doctor Who, they don't really need a particular excuse not to cast a non-Caucasian in Doctor Who, do they?
No, well, exactly. But a lot of the members of the Tong and the other Chinese parts in it, I think most of them are played by East Asian actors. I think the only times when you see a Western actor playing one of the Chinese is when it's a member of the stunt team.
Yeah, yeah. I think they do say, don't they, though, there actually were no Chinese stuntmen in Britain in 1976.
It's quite possible. I mean, there's certainly plenty of Chinese actors. And you know, the rest of the Chinese cast is filled out with Chinese or East Asian actors.
Yeah. It's interesting that when everyone said plenty of Chinese actors, the only one that anyone ever seems to be able to think of is Bert Kwok.
Yes.
Which rather makes the point that they're only aware of one ethnically Chinese actor in the UK at that time. They can't be that many. I think with the racism, I think people tend to hang on to three things, don't they? It's racist to make up John Bennett to look Chinese instead of employing a Chinese actor, which I think with that, it's... well, I'll come on to this in a second. It's... I was thinking of... I mean, you hear people saying, well, a European actor made up to look Chinese wouldn't have been an issue in the 1970s at this time. But the Black and White Minstrel Show was a very live issue at this time. It wasn't a case that people in the, at that time were just thinking, oh, it's, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing this. So you can't use that argument, I don't think.
Mind you, they'd had somebody in yellow face in It Ain't Half Hot Mum, hadn't they, in the year before this as well. I think in an episode that even featured, I know I said there's nothing original in this episode, but the Ain't Half Hot Mum episode even featured the Tong of the Black Scorpion.
Oh, yes, I've heard about that, yeah. I think the issue with here, though, is at the time, did people express unease at that? Did people genuinely not think twice about it?
I don't know. Terry Wood, a Western actor, appears as a Chinese man in another New Avengers episode called Trap, I think around the same time as this, probably a year or so before. So it happens a lot. I mean, that doesn't excuse it. That doesn't make it all right.
No, but it makes it very much of the time, doesn't it? And
it does put it into context. Also, I think if you remember back to the 70s, there was, I mean, there still is to this day, there's distrust of the Chinese in the West. I mean, we've got it at the moment, haven't we? Let's face it, with recent world events that have happened, it's going back in that direction again, that distrust of the Chinese.
And, well, I think it's people like Trump. I've never heard anyone around here saying, blame it on the Chinese.
Yeah, but anyway, I'm talking mainly about the 70s, the era. We had loads of Chinese takeaways, didn't we? And I remember stories all the time when I was a kid growing up, like, don't use that Chinese. You know what? They got raided by the police 6 months ago and they found two Alsatians and a Labrador and a poodle in their freezer, which was clearly bollocks.
Yeah, but who wants to eat a Frenchman? Oh, Alsatians, I see what you mean. Yeah. Yes, that's what you mean.
It's a very common thing, you know. Oh, they eat dogs. Oh, that my dog's gone missing. I'll bet that Chinese takeaway's nicked it. You know, it was that very casual sort of racism and urban myths about them. I mean, that went on to at least the late 80s, I think. I remember hearing stories about dogs in Chinese.
Well, actually, no, they were the same when we were at school as well. We had a local all-you-could-eat Chinese place to my school, and exactly the same story was told when they shut down. So it did continue, yeah.
Yeah, I think there has been this kind of distrust and very easy, casual racism towards it. And I can imagine when they were doing it, you know, they're probably thinking, well, this isn't right, and you know, but let's make it look like the films anyway, because that makes us happy if we make it look like the Fu Manchu films, and nobody's going to care, because who's going to be bothered? And I think that's behind. I don't think it's a deliberate, well, it is deliberate. It's not accidental.
What's deliberate, sorry?
I was going to say that the racism here isn't, they're not deliberately trying to be racist, but, well, you know, they are deliberately doing what they're doing. And so it just seems unnecessary. Like, Tom Baker doesn't have to refer to little people and stuff. And like you said, Lila should not say the yellow one and calling him Lord. Because why would she even...
Yeah, because she's not of the culture, is she? No. It's a cultural...
Why would she look at someone who's got the same skin colour as everyone else around here and call them a yellow one? That is purely in the script. And it's just, that is, yeah, like Doc said, that I think is the worst bit. Because I can't see it in any sort of context.
Do you think it would have been helped if, let's say, for example, take an episode like Rosa, if the Doctor was actually the one maybe saying to Leela, these people were of a more ignorant time, even to have a line like that in there? Do you think the problem is the fact that you have got the main characters also making slurs?
Yes. Yeah, because the Doctor doesn't pull anyone up on it.
Yeah, I see that. That's what I got from it.
I think it's scraping the bit of the bottom of the barrel a little bit to refer to the Doctor saying, I was attacked by a little man, as being racist. I think that's... And I seriously do think that. that's really going sort of trying to find an example of that.
What about when he refers to Mr. Sin as a midget? I'm highlighting points that other people have made, because to me, I've got to say, and I don't know whether I am an incredibly ignorant person. You two know me a lot more than I do, but a lot of this stuff sailed over my head. I was more engaged with the story than I was what was going on with the scripts, you know.
I think you've got different types of, when I say different types of racism, I don't mean in terms of degrees of racism, but you've got, when people call things racism, you've got intrinsic racism, which you can basically boil down to, I hate black people, where it's intended. You've got situational racism, where the historical connotations of something are racist, even if the intent wasn't racist. So, for instance, I don't think you imagine anyone putting on the black and white minstrel show was doing it because they hated black people. But it's undeniable that the history of minstrels, particularly as song and dance acts, is a racist one. Yeah. So you can say that's racist, but you're not necessarily, it's not the same as actually setting out to say or do something racist. Then you've got this three, say, what you might call, say, something that's more socially unhelpful than racist in intent. Where it's not intended to be derogatory, and it isn't actually derogatory, but it's unhelpful. So you'd say, well, it would just be much better, you know, for everyone to get along with each other if you didn't do that sort of thing. I mean, there's one of us has a photo, which none of us appears in, but shall we say it was from the early 80s, suddenly post. I think you'll know what I mean when I say this next bit. Post The Empire Strikes Back coming out, which is what, 1981? 1980. Where you've got... Was it 80? You've got...
It's 40 years this week.
You've got four or five children, about 10 years old, on the corner of some residential streets in the UK. And I don't know if they're all going to a fancy dress party or something. One of them is dressed as Darth Vader.
One of them is...
We won't be mentioning that. Which one's that?
He's a stormtrooper.
That's right. One of them's dressed as Darth Vader. One of them's dressed as a stormtrooper. Obviously, we're in costumes they've made at home. The girl's obviously dressed as Princess Leia with a white dress and Danish pastries on her ears. I think, is one of them dressed as Chewbacca? Or one of them's dressed as Han Solo or something.
Yeah.
And one of them, he's dressed as Lando Calrissian. And he's got the costume on. And he's got sort of a blue cloak. And he's pointing a ray gun at the camera or something. And he clearly thinks, God, don't I look cool?
I mean, he's about 9.
Yeah. But they've taken the realism a step too far.
Yes.
And effectively, his face is blacked up. And you think about that, and you look at that, and you're mildly appalled to see that. But if you look at that, you think, well, that guy, that little boy, he's, oh, my hero is, I want to be Lando.
Mm.
He's my hero. And I bet he's thinking, don't I look amazing? I don't think it particularly helps that he has a blacked up face and blonde hair. and he's clearly thinking, oh, I want to be the black guy.
Mm.
I imagine the people who helped do up his makeup might be his parents. And if they're people who are racist people, they're going to be saying, we'll help black your face up, son. Because they'd be saying, if they're racist, there's no way you're going out with a black face. I'm not having any son of mine doing that. And so that's a case where it's actually, in one way, that little boy wanting to be his hero is the actor, obviously black. Is in one sense a compliment, but you'd say, no, actually, don't do that, because it's deeply offensive to a lot of people. And even if you don't mean to be offensive, for the sake of a little bit of extra visual realism, you're just causing a lot of pain that's not necessary. So you've got these different types of what people look at as racism, but you've got, I think one of the one of the best comparisons that you can sometimes think of is vegetarianism and veganism. I mean, it's entirely possible that in 40 years' time, none of us will be eating meat. And we'll probably all look back at meat eaters in 2020. And it may well be reasonable in 2060 to look back and think, God, that wasn't that awful. They actually used to kill and eat animals. But to make moral judgments on such people, you really have to have been there at the time, I think.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so, for example, I mean, I think that there's three things they focus on when people complain about racism in Talons. One is the use of John Bennett's makeup. Second is they're portraying all the Chinese as baddies. Well, yes, but that's what you get if you use a Chinese tongue in the plot. We're not saying that all Chinese are evil, but we're saying that the people in that sort of tongue are. You don't watch The Godfather, do you, and complain that all the Italian mafiosi are baddies? Where's the nice Italian to counterpoint this? It's a film about the mafia, so they're all bastards. And yes, there are no good Chinese actors to offset this impression, but it's late Victorian London. You weren't going to have a Chinese pathologist or theatrical impresario around or a policeman to show, oh, here's a good guy who's Chinese. But actually, in a way, you do get a good role model for the Chinese, which is going to sound awful, and that's Chang.
Can I just say, I tend to agree with you there. I think it's a very sympathetic portrayal.
Ooh.
And the performance is, in as much as it can be, is reasonably sympathetic, because most of his extreme Chinese caricatures, as I say, for when he's on stage or for when he's... But when he's in general conversation with people, he's very eloquent.
Yeah, he's a baddie. But what do we all know about Doctor Who? The baddies are the cool ones. All those people on the Space Museum who are running around in black pumps. All those boring people on God's Earth because they're the nice guys. The Thals. Thals are always boring because they're the good guys. But Chang, although he's a bad guy, a character who's effortlessly cool.
I mean, the worst thing you can say about him is that he's possibly gullible, but considering the powers that Magnus Greel had, he would look like a god to someone like Chang.
I think it'll seem ironic to say it, but despite the fact he's heavily made up in yellow face makeup, John Bennett's Chang isn't actually a caricature. He's fabulously charismatic. He's given wonderful lines. All this stuff about regaining consciousness in a charnel house and cursing his benefactor. He's actually given, possibly, a more sympathetic characterization than someone like Lightfoot or Jago. And we even get, a bit like Faria in Enemy of the World, he gets our sympathy in that it is death scene, doesn't he?
I regain consciousness in a charnel house, putrefying human remains.
Yes. Rats don't keep a very hygienic larder.
I lay there, Doctor, and cursed Wang Chiang, my benefactor, who had brought me to this fate. Hatred of him gave me the strength to drag myself away. The rats had gone. I came here to destroy the false god, the last act of the great Chiang.
You should have done that before.
I believed in him. For many years, I believed in him.
It was a good act, Chang.
Until he shamed me. I lost face. The whole theater saw my failure.
Tell me about the House of the Dragon.
Next month, the great Chang would have performed before the Queen Empress at Buckingham Palace. I, the son of a peasant.
A House of the Dragon, where is it?
It is his fortress, prepared over many months by the Tong. Beware the eye of the dragon, Doctor.
Lee Sen, come on, come on.
Soon I shall join my ancestors. Already I can see them. They walk to greet me from the Palace of Jade. They are smiling and carry gifts of fruit and flowers. Now I cross the golden bridge of the gods.
And even gets a tribute paid to him in the very last line of the story, which I must say I love.
But it's impossible, Henry. Quite impossible. Good trick, eh? I venture the great Lee Sin Chang himself would have appreciated that.
And so, yeah, you have to portray all the Chinese as baddies. Well, if you're in Victorian London and it's a Chinese tongue who are running things, then they're all going to be baddies.
Mm.
And the third one is, which I think is possibly the most excusable here, is the use of language, where I think people are on firmer ground. People saying, you know, they're saying the yellow one. The sergeant saying, using pidgin English to mock the guy in the police station. And you would expect the doctor to stick up for victims of racial epithets.
Yeah.
But possibly here, because those victims also happen to be the baddies in this story that they're fighting against, that almost makes it impossible. How would the doctor do it? I mean, by taking time out to lecture Leela on not using skin colour to define people. He ought to set an example by not using racial epithets himself. But then you've got the epicanthic eyebrows thing, which I think is far more about looking for a good line. That's, should we say, thoughtlessness, rather than specifically racist intention there. And the little people, well, I think that's... To me, I think that's exaggerated. It's something it's unhelpful, but I don't think it's necessarily racist. What's really interesting here is how more often than not here, yes, there's stuff that you think that a lot earlier than 2020, no one would dream of doing stuff like that. Even, you know, even the most insensitive person wouldn't. I think what's interesting, I think, about the racism is far more interesting than the discovery that people said things in the mid-70s, which you wouldn't say now. Is how often in this script they actually undercut racism and undercut stereotypes. So you've got the police sergeant in the police station telling the, this is something that never gets mentioned but appalls me, that when the final credits roll up, they've got someone playing the role of Cooley.
Yeah.
Which he's referring to, like, the guy as the prisoner. Oh, him George or Plenty, by and by, eh, Johnny? But Chang walks in, and he starts deferring to him. He calls him sir, just in the same way the police constable in the street automatically calls the doctor sir, because of his accent and his clothes and the air of authority. Yeah, okay, Chang's speaking with in inverted commas, Chinese accent. But it's an accent of authority, in the same way the doctor is. So that the sort of class of person who's going to be a policeman instantly recognises in that... In that Victorian era, this is a guy who's above me on the social ladder. I call him sir, I defer to him. Might even be just that Chang is incredibly famous, you know, as being on the musical stage. Chang is actually given an opportunity to get a dig at European racism by saying,
Don't I know you?
I think not.
Yes, I've seen you somewhere before.
I understand we all look the same.
And then the doctor gets an even better dig back.
Are you Chinese?
And he gets a bigger dig at Europeans, which I'm sure is going to be intentional in the script. Now he puts on a stage persona of a Chinese caricature. Please be very, very careful. You know, Chang shoots 15 peasants learning this. Let me rephrase that. Please be very, very careful. Chang shoots 15 peasants learning this tlic. And then one of us is yellow. Which is, you think, ooh, but he's clearly...
Oh, he's playing to the crowd.
Yeah, he's playing to the crowd and taking the piss out of them a bit. Perhaps another good example is the use of the word midget. You don't find anyone banging on about prejudicing talents ever seems to mention that, except Tatum, just a few minutes ago.
Oh, it's
almost as if they unconsciously accept, oh, yeah, that's the word people used to use in those days, but we don't do it now.
Mm.
We don't make a fuss about it.
Which is the same attitude towards a lot of the other things that we just said, isn't it?
Mm.
Well, it's not the same attitude they have towards other things said. So it's okay to use a derogatory term against someone of shortened height, because you can explain that as being, that's just what people would have said at the time, but it's not okay.
I don't think it's okay for the doctor to say it.
No, I don't.
And it's possibly a case here that they've thought, well, we're going to use Chinese people. Robert Holmes has maybe thought, I'll start playing around with things like that. But when you do play around with things like that, oh, I'll give them Chang, you know, I'll have him being really sublimely authoritative off stage. But on stage, I'll have him putting on this, and that will be, you know, that'll be a little dig at this and that. But if you're playing with dangerous ideas like that, then you are going to slip up and have the Doctor say that, and have Leela say that. I can't believe they had Leela say that. Even in 1977, people would have realised it to say the yellow one. Mm. Would have... But that, I think Hayden makes a good... Was it you, Hayden, who makes a good point? Is that she wouldn't say that. Because he isn't yellow. In the same way that she wouldn't refer to the Doctor as the white one. No. Because white people aren't white. You know what I mean? Mm. I mean, I recognise it's all stuff that you think I agree would never do today. But I think people sort of go over the top about it, trying to portray it as something evil. It's something that people lived in a society in those days where just people didn't think about these things. In the same way that when I finished this recording, I'm going to have some cheese and biscuits. Hardly anyone listening to this podcast will bat an epicanthic eyelid at. But what I'm doing is what we do to cows. We keep cows, we rear them to be effectively constantly pregnant so that they're constantly producing calves, so that they're constantly producing milk, so that we can use that to either drink or to make cheese with. Who thinks twice? I mean, that's in a way. Imagine if there was a story in Doctor Who where... I mean, this is a good idea. And you can use this, Chris, if you like, for next season. You've got a situation where an alien race are rearing humans like that. I suppose it's almost the plot of V, isn't it?
Yes.
To be used as meat. And that sort of thing, I think, would make people far more stop and think, oh, God, what am I doing, you know, eating a chicken sandwich, than, you know, a lecture to camera on this sort of thing. A chicken sandwich? Are you gesturing me? Halo Jones reference there. But the point I'm making is it doesn't occur to me to think. In a way, we're almost socially brainwashed not to think. I don't mean deliberately, aren't we? But, you know, we say, oh, look at those, that lovely lamb gambling in the field. Mm. Oh, doesn't it look cute? And you go home and have a lamb chop or something. And you really don't think twice about it, do you?
I've started thinking twice about it, hence.
I will now.
I'd just like it to be known that just because I don't jump onto the racism in Talon's bandwagon doesn't mean that I don't think about these moral issues. Anyway, I've been talking for too long. I'm far too hungry. Mark, can you pass me the vol-au-vents, please?
Here you are.
Thank you. What's the filling?
Foie gras.
Yummy.
I'm of the opinion that I think people are only looking for the next outrage, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, you're seeing it now with the pictures of people on the beaches during lockdown.
Mm.
Yeah, okay, it's not a great idea to be in large groups of people, but actually, when you look at some of the angles these people are taking photographs of, it looks like they're not socially distancing. When the person zooms the picture out, yes, they're socially distancing. Do you know what I mean? It's there to sort of cause outrage, and I think, I mean, this is of its time, and it's going to be of its time because it was recorded at that point where this sort of thing was still okay, and you can just look at it, take the historical element of it in hand and say, okay, well, yeah, we wouldn't do this now, but the story is so good for me that it doesn't ruin the enjoyment of the programme for me.
No.
At all. And I think if it did, then the show's not doing its job. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of... I don't think 1977 Doctor Who is there to tell people that this kind of thing is wrong. You know, we've gone past the Barry Letts era where, you know, we are trying to get through bigger world problems and try and talk about them more to a younger audience. And Doctor Who's doing it now, but even when Doctor Who does it now, it causes outrage because people say how preachy it is. It's just, you just can't win. You just got to take these things in the context of what they were at the time, and hopefully they don't ruin your enjoyment. There's a James Bond film where Sean Connery undergoes a transformation, let's say, which...
That's extraordinary. That's how no one ever...
Yeah.
Well, maybe in the circles that you frequent, Hayden. You don't hear anyone criticising that, do you?
Not as much, no. No,
as much as you, he is deliberately trying to disguise himself as Japanese, isn't he?
It's worse in the books. It's worse in the books because Ian Fleming was...
Oh, God, I've just started watching the Sweeney through with Doc. I've seen most of it before, years ago. But I've started trying to read the novelizations. Well, not novelizations, they're original stories. And the racism and homophobia in the Sweeney novels is just off the scale. There's always a bit of, you know, in 70s television, like the Sweeney stuff, there will be sort of a bits of casual racism, bits of casual homophobia. Yeah. And that is because that's kind of what the characters... they would have been casually racist and homophobic, sometimes virulently so. Like like Regan in that first episode where he says, "I hate krauts." But it's part of the character. But in the books, it goes so deep into it.
I was quite shocked at that. I hate krauts.
Yeah, I think that's more because he's with her, with his ex-wife. So that's... And he's had a drink. So.
And he's Inspector Morse.
Even in recent times, though, you've got shows... I mean, Red Dwarf, there's an episode... There's like a Bond-style pre-title sequence with Ace Rimmer. It's basically Chris Barry on a motorbike blowing up a load of Nazis. And at one point turns around and delivers a Roger Moore-style quip saying, "I bet he's a sauerkraut." Like I'm saying, you know, this is stuff which is still incredibly very recent. It's only really in the last 8, 9, 10 years where people have highlighted this and, oh, isn't this outrageous? Isn't this terrible? And yes, it is. It is. It isn't right.
I mean, I think when I used to watch Allo Allo when I was a kid, I used to think, I'm sure this is racist. I didn't particularly like it. I didn't used to find it funny either. And since I've discovered Secret Army, I like it even less. But
do you think that was saved a little bit back then by the policeman character speaking in French but getting all the words wrong? Possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, not really. The problem for me with that is I don't particularly like Allo Allo. I didn't used to find it very funny. Whereas I do like The Talents of Ming Chiang. I do like... there's a Bonzo Dog Doodle Band video. There's an appearance they did on Do Not Just Your Set in the late 60s. They appear on it doing a song. There's a monster coming. And they're all blacked up. And at one point, one of them even has like a little kind of rubber inner tube, or like a small one, which he holds in front of his mouth in like squeezed in half, so it looks like a pair of big lips.
Yeah.
And
oh dear.
Yeah, and I can't bear when you're watching like a sort of playlist of their videos that will pop up, and I generally tend to skip that one. Does it make me dislike the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band or make me love them any less? I do utterly adore them. No, it doesn't. No.
It's interesting that I can watch Wang Chiang without being that bothered. Obviously, I mean, the extreme bits, like the Yiltain yellow one and the policeman doing Eugene Pigeon English, and sometimes the more close-up shots of John Bennett's makeup, which quite reminds you of particularly around the eyes of what's happening is shocking, but I can watch it and I can think that in the back of my mind as, yeah, that's what they used to do in those days, because you can't imagine, I mean, we don't know, do we, but you can't imagine that that Philip Hinchcliffe, who must have okayed this, is some sort of racist unless he hides it very well, do you? But I can't watch Two of the Cybermen without being deeply disturbed at the character of Toberman. I mean, that really takes me out of the story, though.
Yeah, I find that more bothersome than... That bothers me more than this. And not to mention the woman in it as well isn't exactly a...
Oh, Kaftan.
Yeah. This is not the only incident of racism. And it's not the worst. Mm. I don't think this is the worst incident of racism in Doctor Who history. I just think it's one of the greatest episodes of Doctor Who, generally, in terms of quality of script, production, performances, writing. And I think that because of that, it draws a lot more attention to itself. And because there are people who will go and say, but that isn't racist, and will deny that it's racist. And I don't think there's anything wrong with recognising that it's got racist elements in it and realising that elements of it can be offensive to certain people. I mean, if certain people are offended by it, then they're offended by it. And that's... understandable. Mm. You know, I'm not sure I'd feel happy if I was watching it and, like in Father Ted, the Chinese family from next door decides to pop round. Would I leave it playing? I don't think I would. Although hopefully I wouldn't wave at them through the window with a tiny bit of black dirt on it.
Are the train scriptures in Father Ted?
No, there's one episode.
And that is interesting, isn't it? Because if Talons was on and your Chinese next door neighbour popped round for a cup of sugar, you'd turn it off, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's... Is that me saying, here am I intellectualising the notions of racism, but I actually know, you know, in my heart that that's going to be offensive. Well, maybe that goes back to what I was saying about something is offensive. Something may not have been intended as being racially offensive, but people find it offensive.
Yes.
And some of us would rather live in a society where we all get along. Mm. And so it's best not to, you know, push these things.
And you don't want to embarrass yourself. You don't want them to come around and think, oh, well, so that's what you think of Chinese people, is it?
Yeah.
It also links into the way people are brought up these days. I mean, I don't know about you two, but I was never told as I was being brought up, you mustn't discriminate against women, Jews, blacks, gays, Chinese or whatever. I was brought up in a family where they just didn't.
Mm.
I never saw anyone... If I ever saw anyone being treated differently, it would have just been on TV. I never saw it at home.
That's a very good point, yeah.
And so I grew up with the idea that, well, you don't treat people differently. And yes, of course, as I grew older, I realised that, you know, what the world was like.
Mm.
And I'm not saying I'm perfect or anything.
You both may have been quite lucky because you were brought up in areas which were quite... possibly quite diverse. I wasn't. I was brought up in a small village in Essex and lived there for 25 years.
Know. Northeast Manchester. You very, very rarely saw any...
My childhood wasn't particularly diverse. Okay. It was very, very, very white.
But I know people now who will still refer, like, make racial slurs.
Mm.
You know, as if no one's going to bat an eyelid. And I think it is down to... you know, the area where you were brought up and your experiences. And I think some of us have a very nice way of looking at life, which is where you treat others as though as you would like to be treated, you know, and it doesn't matter what that person is. I mean, it is disturbing that there are still people who do think this way. Do you know what? We've ended up spending about an hour talking about the racism of Talons.
And we were thinking, weren't we? Wouldn't it be a great way of really pissing off the people who bang on about racism? Shall we just annoy them by defending it? Or would it really annoy them even worse if we just didn't mention it at all? But what I was saying about that, about the way people are brought up, I suspect that some people are brought up these days that say, you mustn't behave like that because it's racist. You mustn't say things like that because it's sexist. You mustn't take that attitude because it's homophobic or something. Instead of simply teaching them not to treat people differently and then leaving them to work out for themselves that certain words and behaviour and actions are discriminatory. Then they don't end up saying, that's racist. And when someone asks them to explain why, they're left thinking, because it is, isn't it? Which is the way I was brought up. I don't think I ever saw. I can't have seen many black faces on the street in the mid-60s. I do remember vaguely, I mean, when I was at school, I think in a class of, say, 25, there might be one black or Asian kid. That's just the way it was. Whereas now it's going to be much, much different. Let's get off this.
Yeah.
So I think the conclusion is Talon's good, racism bad.
Yes.
Would anyone like to, this is going to be extremely generous on my part, would anyone like to contribute?
I just would like to say, I think this is an awesome story for Leela. It's Leela with cricket bat, Leela with carving knife, Leela dining with Lightfoot, Leela saying to the doctor, you ask me so you can tell me.
Yeah.
Leela leaping on Magnus Greel and screaming, die, bent face. Just, absolutely superb. A delight in this story, I find.
And for all the Eliza Doolittle themes here, she's never been portrayed as thick, has she?
No.
Just an educator. You get that, how that sort of really cool for Ranskill Gardens. He heard you tell the driver. Although quite how she knows that for her first time ever on Earth, that for Ranskill Gardens is an address. It might just be, I don't know. And the thing about water bags, you know, like, oh, like a water bag with a hole in it. Yeah, I think she's great here. And I don't get the impression. I don't know. Maybe it's just because the Doctor's playing an authoritative figure, as he always has, Tom. She's playing a very, you know, she's not playing the submissive female role. So I don't really notice this idea that he was resenting her at the time. Do you get any of that from this?
No.
No, not at all.
Oh, one last thing I do want to say. I love possibly Leela's best line, possibly one of the best lines ever in the show, is where she says,
Doctor, Professor Lightfoot and Mr. Jago are our friends. We must help them. You know what will happen if Wang Chiang finds them.
I think at that moment I would just, if I ever at the time had thought, I don't know if I did, had thought, oh, I'm not sure about this new companion, I would imagine I would have fallen in love with her right then. That is so much the essence of what Doctor Who should be about. Doctor doesn't come and help you because he's on a mission to save the universe. He'll help you because she's your friend. And you wouldn't want to, particularly want to go out and travel in the TARDIS because you want to moan about not getting back to Heathrow. You do because you'd want to be the Doctor's friend. It's like the little girl on Who's Doctor Who says,
I didn't like it when the man got crushed in the machine and was put into the soil in the garden. The monster didn't really scare me, but I didn't like that bit. Well, he did deserve it because he was trying to kill Sarah and the Doctor. He wasn't very nice. He was horrible. Because the baddies have got to be got rid of anyway.
And I thought, I fell in love with that little girl. So she said that, oh, she knows. She understands Doctor Who. Right. Marks out of 10? Degrees of racism out of 10?
It's so racist, I filled the boat up.
I would say 8.5.
I think it's possible to recognise the problems in it and still absolutely adore this. It's a solid 9 for me because I just think it's... it would be 10 if it wasn't for the problems, I think, because that's the only... Because I don't care about crappy rats. I don't care about dodgy-looking rats.
There's the episode title. I'm a bit more generous than you two. I think it's 9.5.
I think you're both only saying that to try and outdo me.
I think it's 9.6.
Oh, 9.65 then, shall we?
Oh! 9.652.
it's genuinely one of the best. For its problems, it's still one of the very best.
I think we can draw things to a close.
Well, we haven't said goodbye.
I'm just wondering how we're going to do it. Who have we got?
Well, that's us cancelled.
Sorry.
Oh, look, here come the Sons of Skaro Daleks to wish us goodbye. Hello, Derek Skaros. Have you got anything to tell us?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Ray. We have anti-Dalek force ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap!
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum!
Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.